On this 18th day of May, 2011, in San Diego, we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. We are in Chapter 2, entitled Contents of the Gita Summarized, and we are on text number 225. Avyakto yam achintoyam Abhikaryo yam uchyate Tasmadevam vididvainam Namashochitam arhasi. Translation: it is said that the soul is invisible, inconceivable, and immutable. Knowing this, you should not grieve for the body. Purport: as described previously, the magnitude of the soul is so small for our material calculation that he cannot be seen even by the most powerful microscope. Therefore, he is invisible. As far as the soul's existence is concerned, no one can establish his existence experimentally beyond the proof of Shruti, or Vedic wisdom. We have to accept this truth because there is no other source of understanding the existence of the soul, although it is a fact by perception. There are many things we have to accept solely on the grounds of superior authority. No one can deny the existence of his father based upon the authority of his mother. There is no source of understanding the identity of the father except by the authority of the mother. Similarly, there is no source of understanding the soul except by studying the Vedas. In other words, the soul is inconceivable by human experimental knowledge. The soul is consciousness and conscious. That also is the statement of the Vedas, and we have to accept that. Unlike the bodily changes, there is no change in the soul. As eternally unchangeable, the soul remains atomic in comparison to the infinite Supreme Soul. The Supreme Soul is infinite, and the atomic soul is infinitesimal. Therefore, the infinitesimal soul, being unchangeable, can never become equal to the finite infinite soul, or the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This concept is repeated in the Vedas in different ways, just to confirm the stability of the conception of the soul. Repetition of something is necessary in order that we understand the matter thoroughly, without error. And we did read this verse. I remember reading the purport. So we'll just go on. Text 26. Atachainam nitya jatam nityam vamam nisemritam tatapi tvam mahabaho nainam shotitum arhasi. If, however, you think that the soul or the symptoms of life will always be born and die forever, you still have no reason to lament, O mighty armed. There is always a class of philosophers, almost akin to the Buddhists, who do not believe in the separate existence of the soul beyond the body. When Lord Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita, it appears that such philosophers existed, and they were known as the Lokayitakas and the Vaibhashikas. Such philosophers maintain that life symptoms take place at a certain mature condition of material combination. The modern material scientists and materialist philosophers also think similarly. According to them, the body is a combination of physical elements, and at a certain stage, the life symptoms develop by interaction of the physical and chemical elements. The science of anthropology is based on this philosophy. Currently, many pseudo-religions, now becoming fashionable in America, are also adhering to this philosophy, as are the nihilistic, non-devotional Buddhist sects. Even if Arjuna did not believe in the existence of the soul, as in the Vaibhashika philosophy, there would still have been no cause for lamentation. No one laments the loss of a certain bulk of chemicals and stops discharging his prescribed duty. On the other hand, in modern science and scientific warfare, so many tons of chemicals are wasted for achieving victory over the enemy. According to the Vaibhashika philosophy, the so-called soul or atma vanishes along with the deterioration of the body. So in any case, whether Arjuna accepted the Vedic conclusion that there is an atomic soul, or he did not believe in the existence of the soul, he had no reason to lament. According to this theory, since there are so many living entities generating out of matter every moment, and so many of them are being vanquished every moment, there is no need to grieve for such incidents. If there were no rebirth for the soul, Arjuna had no reason to be afraid of being affected by sinful reactions due to his killing his grandfather and teacher. But at the same time, Krishna sarcastically addressed Arjuna as Mahabahu, mighty armed, because he, Krishna at least, did not accept the theory of the Vaibhashikas, which leaves aside the Vedic wisdom. As a Kshatriya, Arjuna belonged to the Vedic culture, and it behooved him to continue to follow its principles. Om jnana timarandasya jnananjana shalakya chukshu unmiditam mena tasmai shri gurave namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisance to him and all members of Sri Parampara. So this is a little detour into the possibility of impersonalist or nihilist philosophy. But the point is that Krishna is trying to convince Arjuna to fight in this battle. So from every angle, he's defeating Arjuna's argument. The first is that, as Krishna says, the soul is eternal. So there's really no death at all. And all you're doing, if you kill Bhishma and Drona and these others that are dear to you, is simply speeding their destiny destination going into the next body. And the key fact of all this is that you will be doing it not on the basis of some egotistical motive, but on the basis of my desire, on the basis of what is right and true. And that mitigates any reaction. In other words, you will not be suffering sinful reaction by fighting in this war, but by not fighting it. That comes up. Arjuna's worried about getting sinful reaction for destroying the dynasty. The women will be unprotected. There will be Varna Sankara, which means unwanted population, untrained children coming. This is a big consideration. He's very concerned. Arjuna is a soft-hearted Vaishnav, and he wants to do the right thing. He wants to preserve the social fabric. But the fact is that if he doesn't fight and Duryodhana remains the king, then the evil will be running the society. And we see from other instances, both in the Bhagavatam and in our own society, how devastating that can be. If someone who is just more or less a gangster, runs the country, then the people suffer like anything. I mean, we've seen that in society. It's happening right today in certain parts of the world. So it's very, very important that the leader of any society, in this case the world, be a devotee, be dharmic, follow the rules and regulations given down by Krishna, by the Vedas, and truly is concerned about the welfare of the people. The ideal in this regard is Lord Ram. Ram Raj is called, the kingdom of Ram, in which God himself was the ruling king, and naturally he had the welfare of the people in heart, and they felt that. They felt protected like a father protects his children. So that's the big concern. And so, but in case Arjuna thought that, okay, it's just there's no eternal soul, and it's just life comes into being when you're born, and when you die, that you cease to exist, then what's the problem? Still there's no problem. Because there can't be any sinful reaction because there's no eternal soul. And the same argument still holds. Well, it's still Krishna's desire. It's still for the benefit of everybody. You still want, it's still foolish to have this sentiment, that's preventing you from being an instrument to reinstitute the best thing for so many people. So that's really the determining factor. Otherwise, without this, Krishna's directly speaking this, then you have to rely on, and without any access to the Vedic literature and higher intelligence, then you have to figure out what is the best thing to do. And you devolve onto what is the best for myself personally, or my clan, or my nation. That becomes the criterion. And that's why we have this called the Age of Kali. The Age of Kali means the age of quarrel and war and constant strife. And we can see it all around us. Where is the, they try to establish after World War II, it was so devastating. People had been, it was so monstrous what had gone on. I said, okay, now we'll have a United Nations and we'll try to stop any war from occurring. So what do they try to do with the United Nations? To establish some kind of a body that can judge. No, you can't. You can't go to war here. It's illegal, and to try to stop another war from taking place. But has it stopped the wars? There's so many wars, you know, that have taken place since then. And there's always that threat of the big war, you know. And for so many years, it was the Cold War, you know. But the threat of the nuclear annihilation. And the fact is that it's still there. That threat is still there. The weapons are still there. But somehow, you know, by Krishna's grace, they haven't gone off yet. You know, we hope they don't. But the point is, without the reference, without being guided by the Brahmins who are steeped in this knowledge and actually pure souls, society is without a head. You know, the Brahmins who are austere, renounced devotees who know the science, if they're actually advising the kings or the rulers and the executive heads, then there's the possibility of a harmonious society that really looks out for the welfare, not only material but spiritual of the people. But without that, and we certainly don't have that now, it's like without the head, there's madness and there's chaos everywhere. So we don't have to worry too much about this philosophy. But the idea is that from this angle also, Arjuna should not feel hesitant to fight. Is that even if, you know, life is a one-shot deal. You come into being and then you go out of being and there's nothing else. There's no reason to lament the loss of chemicals. You know, that was the Krishna's argument. Yeah. All right, let's go on to the next one. Jata sehi dhruvam mityur. Dhruvam janma matasya cha tasmad abadihayarte natvam shotitum arhasi. One who has taken his birth is sure to die, and after death one is sure to take birth again. Therefore, in the unavoidable discharge of your duty, you should not lament. Purport. One has to take birth according to one's activities of life. And after finishing one term of activities, one has to die to take birth for the next. In this way, one is going through one cycle of birth and death after another without liberation. This cycle of birth and death does not, however, support unnecessary murder, slaughter, and war. But at the same time, violence and war are inevitable factors in human society for keeping law and order. The Battle of Kurukshetra, being the will of the Supreme, was an inevitable event. And to fight for the right cause is the duty of a Kshatriya. Why should he, Arjuna, be afraid of or aggrieved at the death of his relatives, since he was discharging his proper duty? He did not deserve to break the law, thereby becoming subjected to the reactions of sinful acts, of which he was so afraid. By avoiding the discharge of his proper duty, he would not be able to stop the death of his relatives, and he would be degraded due to his selection of the wrong path of action. So, another expanded meaning here is tasmanda parihariyate, since everyone who is born dies, and that person will also be reborn, you should not lament for the inevitable. It's inevitable that they'll die anyway. All you're doing is hastening that for the cause of reestablishing Dharma in the world. So it does them good, also, you know, because they're going to be killed in the presence of Krishna. Anyone who's killed in the presence of Krishna gets a higher destination. So all these thousands and thousands of soldiers, it's their great fortune. They have to die eventually anyway. But you're going to die in the presence of the Lord, oh, that's very fortunate. And so since it's unavoidable, and also because it was Krishna's will, the battle will be fought anyway, whether Arjuna fights it or not. But if he fights in the battle, then he'll be exalted, he'll be serving Krishna, he'll be in his right position, he'll enjoy the kingdom for the right reasons. If he doesn't, he'll lose his reputation, he'll be committing sin by not fighting under Krishna's order, and therefore, you know, receive sinful action, which is precisely what he was afraid of getting by killing. You see, he's got everything backwards. This is the typical situation of the conditioned soul. Everything is backwards. Remember those verses, I don't know if you remember, the prayers of Akura. He uses this word, Viparyaya. Viparyaya means reverse. It comes up periodically in the teachings of the nine yogendras, Tamarajnimi, the source of fear. It's a big deal, you know, because material life is always fraught with fear, because you're a permanent soul, eternally existing in an atmosphere of threat of imminent annihilation at any moment. So there's inevitably fear. That not being fearful is kind of a blessing of Krishna. But the real condition is there's danger at every step. So how does this fear come about? One of the yogendras explains, bhayam buddhiya binaveshituk syad ishad apityasya viparyayos asmriti. See, viparya means reverse. So bhayam buddhiya abhinaveshita means becoming absorbed in this duality or this second reality. In other words, the material world. By absorbing our minds in the matter and forgetting Krishna means ishada petasya, turning away from the isha, the Lord, you see, and therefore become absorbed in matter. So it becomes fearful. Just as Prahlad said, because asadgrahat, the mind is always disturbed because you're absorbed or grabbing onto the asat, the temporary. So bhayam dvitiya binaveshitak syad brings into being ishada pitasya viparyayo smriti. So you forget asmriti, you've forgotten, and your position is reversed. Means, just as Akura says, anityanatma dukeshu viparya matiryaham. You hear that word viparya? So anitya anatma dukeshu, that which is not permanent, anitya, I'm taking to be my permanent situation. This is the most amazing thing, according to Yudhishthira, is that day by day by day, every day, millions and millions of people die in this world. Who can deny it? You know, and others are born. But millions of people are dying. But those who are still here are living and thinking and working on the basis that you'll always be here. You know, this is the way people work. They can become completely absorbed, even in their old age. You know? Like, I always marvel at this guy, what's his name? Steve Jobs? Is this the way you pronounce his name? The guy, Apple guy, right? So there he is. The guy's up, dying on his feet, right? He's thin. Obviously, he's sick. You know? He's got cancer. And he's still, you know, introducing these new gadgets. And he's so excited about it, you know? The guy's about to die. You know, and he's absorbed in the little gadget. Oh, we're going to make him, so he's a billionaire, I'll make 2 billion, you know. It's insanity. He's absorbed in the, you know, and oh, okay, we got to take a leave of absence. Yeah, get a liver transplant, you know. And here's a fellow who used to take prasadam in Stanford. He met the devotees. And recently they tried to contact him again. He didn't want to talk to him. This is the tragedy of material absorption. Once you get into it, you know, that which is the most important thing seems insignificant. I don't want to talk to you guys. What can you tell me? You know, that which is the most insignificant, your billions of dollars and the whole Apple thing and the computers, and ultimately it doesn't mean anything. It's just the flickering screen. That's most important. In this way, life is wasted. Here's an intelligent guy. He could influence billions, or millions anyway, just like George did, George Harrison. No. See, this is the intoxication of great wealth. It is said in the Bhagavatam, it is the death of the soul. Great wealth is practically the death of the soul. You know? I mean, here we are sitting here, our net wealth, you know, worth is probably $1,000 of that. You know? But we're much more fortunate than these billionaires, believe me. Just believe me. They are, you know, you put up this huge barrier of wealth and power and influence, and you think they think they're God. That's what Aishwarya means. Aishwarya is wealth. It means being like an Ishwara, and the controller. But here this verse says, Ishada petasya, and your knowledge is reversed. So anitya natma dukeshu, that which is not permanent, is temporary, can leave at any moment, you're taken to be steady and solid and, you know, most important. That which is not you, the body, the extended family, your name and fame and position, all of that's not you. It has nothing to do with you as a soul. That's me. And dukeshu, the sources of misery I'm taking to be sources of happiness. And in this mad situation, through the looking glass, right, on the other side, everything's reversed, right? Have you ever read Alice in Wonderland? I read it many, you know, when I was a kid. Nothing makes sense, right? You make up the language as you go along. It's all like a crazy dream world. We're in the dream world. So it says, Dvanva Arama. I'm trying to enjoy the dualities of this world. And entering Tamo Vishta further and further into the darkness of ignorance. This is a Krura. He's a great Acharya, actually. And then the greatest tragedy, Natvaham. I forget the Sanskrit. So, and the worst thing is, I can't understand that you are my dearmost friend, O Krishna. You know, I've forgotten you completely in all of this madness. So this is the reversed situation. And this whole Krishna consciousness is meant to turn things right side up again, to understand who we really are, what our constitutional position is, and that we can be happy in that constitutional position and not any other way. Not any other way. Unless we're situated as devotees of Krishna, devotees of God, we'll never be happy. You may think you're happy for some time, but if you think about it, your happiness is depending on so many conditions, material conditions, which must change. Just like this whole thing with the crash. You know, I remember back in September of 2008, I was with my friend in Alachua. When suddenly the bottom fell out, you know, of the whole mortgage thing and the stock market and Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers. Oh, Lehman Brothers. Billions. So many thousands of people, you know, all over the world. Suddenly, boom, it's finished. So that means that suddenly this great fear comes over. They have this idea of the financial panic. You know, we had one in the Great Depression, but they had periodically financial panics, you know. Because people invest their lives in their wealth, in their money. And suddenly it's not there or it's threatened. And they become panic-stricken, you know. Sell, you know, try to escape, you know. That's a financial panic. So that's fear personified all over the world. You know, we don't feel it because you got nothing. You're much wealthier. Each one of you here is wealthier than the whole United States. The whole United States is $14 trillion in debt. Does anyone here owe anything like that? Then you're wealthier. They're below water. But, you know, there's such anxiety. There's three things Prabhupada said you have to take care of right away. You know what they are? You know? Fire, debt, and disease. Because they all get worse if you don't do anything, right? That's why we have fire departments. If you don't do anything, more burns up, the whole city will burn up. So you know, how do you get fire, debt, and disease? So that's the nature of this material world. You know, there's all of these dangers, and they just get worse. So we have to turn right side up again. So to complete this verse, you know, this is a very wonderful verse about fear. So how did we get into this fearful situation? By turning from Krishna, you know? By the influence of maya, tanmayato. That's the beginning of the third line. So one has to be buddha, has to be intelligent. Tanmayato buddha atmanoyam. Tanmayato buddha atmanoyam. Bhakti-aikayesham guru-devatatma. And has to render one-pointed eka bhakta to the Isha, who you turned away from. And, very important line here, Guru Deva Tatma, considering one's guru, one's worshipful lord, and very self. In other words, it all keys on getting in touch with the representative of the Lord. We need an intercession. We need someone to guide us and give us, extend to us Krishna's mercy. And then one can be situated beyond fear. And I just read today how this fearfulness, which after all, you know, let's just think about this a minute. What is terrorism? Terrorism is trying to induce fear in people, you know, for a certain end, so that they'll do something or refrain from doing something, right? So if people are always afraid, which is what happened after 9/11, it's been almost 10 years now. And if you recall that situation, Americans were riled up, right, fearful. Yes, protect us. We can see what they can do to us, you know. The boogeyman, Osama. And it's absurd. Here you have the strongest, you know, nation in the world and we were completely frightened by this guy. I'm sitting in a cave somewhere. But they were able to do it by this PSYOP called 9/11. So then when people are afraid, they'll do practically anything. You know, it's kind of a different part of your brain that works. You know, fight or flight. Or take my money and protect me. You know, billions and billions were made on the basis of scaring people. Go to wars. People go to war and support wars on the basis of fear. So the leaders know all we have to do is frighten the people. We can send them to war. They'll pay for it. So you can just see the advantage of getting to a position where you're beyond fear. That's why this song is there. Bajahure manashi nandanandan abaya charanarabindure. Oh, mine, worship the fearless lotus feet. Now, what does that mean, fearless lotus feet? Those lotus feet which give fearlessness. We just got through the Sringadeva's appearance day. Prahlad Maharaj was the personification of fearlessness. What could be more fearful than this monstrous demon as a father trying to kill you? So you see, even in the face of danger, to be fearless. Now, at one point, we're all going to lose our body. Your body's going to go. But if you actually understand his philosophy and you're situated in your sarup, meaning that you're serving Krishna internally as well as externally, then it's just like we just read a few verses earlier, taking off an old coat. Remember the verse? Vasangsi Jirna. You see the value of that. So much, money is spent counteracting fear, anxiety, which is simply internalized permanent fear, right? Depression. It's all come from the same source. Cutting ourselves off from Krishna. Cutting ourselves off from devotional service. So this is the movement that can really solve all these problems. Every problem begins in here. It begins with the consciousness. They're trying to fix the thing externally. They'll never be able to do it. The solution to all material and spiritual problems is the ultimate spiritual solution, bhakti yoga. Any questions or comments? Jata Sahi Dhruva Mitra. Okay. Text 28. Avyaktadini Bhutani.
Avyaktadini Bhutani.
Vyaktamadhyani Bharata.
Avyakta
nidanānyeva
tatraka
paridevana. All created beings are unmanifest in their beginning, manifest in their interim state, and unmanifest again when annihilated. So what need is there for lamentation? Accepting that there are two classes of philosophers, one believing in the existence of the soul and the other not believing in the existence of the soul, there is no cause for lamentation in either case. Non-believers in the existence of the soul are called atheists by followers of Vedic wisdom. Yet even if, for argument's sake, we accept this atheistic theory, there is still no cause for lamentation. Apart from the separate existence of the soul, the material elements remain unmanifested before creation. From this subtle state of non-manifestation comes manifestation. Just as from ether, air is generated, from air, fire is generated, from fire, water is generated, and from water, earth becomes manifested. From the earth, many varieties of manifestations take place. Take, for example, a big skyscraper manifested from the earth. When it is dismantled, the manifestation becomes again unmanifested and remains as atoms in the ultimate stage. The law of conservation of energy remains, but in course of time, things are manifested and unmanifested. That is the difference. Then what cause is there for lamentation, either in the stage of manifestation or in unmanifestation? Somehow or other, even in the unmanifested stage, things are not lost. Both at the beginning and at the end, all elements remain unmanifested, and only in the middle are they manifested, and this does not make any real material difference. And if we accept the Vedic conclusion, as stated in the Bhagavad Gita, that these material bodies are perishable in due course of time, antabanta ime deha, but that the soul is eternal, nitya syokta sharirinaha, then we must remember always that the body is like a dress. Therefore, why lament the changing of a dress? The material body has no factual existence in relation to the eternal soul. It is something like a dream. In a dream, we may think of flying in the sky or sitting on a chariot as a king. But when we wake up, we can see that we are neither in the sky nor seated on the chariot. The Vedic wisdom encourages self-realization on the basis of the non-existence of the material body. Therefore, in either case, whether one believes in the existence of the soul or one does not believe in the existence of the soul, there is no cause for lamentation for loss of the body. So this idea of the dream, it comes up again and again. You know, how to awaken from this dreaming state. First of all, we have to understand that we're dreaming. You know, that's the hard part. Because in the conditioned state, we invest so much in this dreamlike existence. You know, we put a lot into it. And it's not easy to suddenly discard that. You know, you eventually wake up. You know, if you don't wake up before, you wake up at death. It's a big shock. You know, the big shock is you're not dead. You're not dead. For most people, probably there's these ugly characters dragging you off somewhere. You know, you're not dead. You're conscious. And, you know, it's not... Now, with so many years now, we've had these near-death experiences, these accounts of people. There's empirical evidence. You know, of people almost dying and then coming back and say, oh my goodness, this is what I experienced. I saw them working on me, pounding my heart, you know. They could describe who came in. They could describe, you know, the beeps that were going on. According to the machines, they're practically flatlining. There's no brain activity. So how did that happen? You know, and there's so many other accounts of that. Irrefutable. You know, there are accounts of children. This is, you know, a very wonderful thing. Ian Stevenson did so many investigations. And there's one guy on the internet, this boy from the Midwest. Did you see that one? He's an only guy in some Methodist family or something, you know. And he's a kid. He wakes up, you know, and he grows up and he's got this uncontrollable desire for play with planes. He's always playing with planes. Well, kids play with planes, but he really wanted to play with planes. That's all he wanted to play with. So it turns out, you know, he started to give all of this names and things and experiences about being shot down over the Pacific. You remember that? So it turns out there was, you know, they did some investigation. There was some guy named this. He knew the name of the plane. You know, in other words, there's no way that he could have gotten that except from a previous life. And he's ordinary, like Methodist, you know, people had to admit, yeah, it looks like he's been reincarnated. It's just not part of their religion, but there's no way to deny it. So, you know, there's enough of that around to corroborate, you know, Krishna's statement. We don't need it, but that's there. So, but that changes the whole game, you know. It's not just this one kid, it's everybody who goes through this. So what does that mean? It means that the previous life that we had is like a dream to us, you know. It's a dream that we forgot. I mean, how many dreams have we forgot over this one lifetime? Thousands. But each one, you know, was some kind of reality while it was taking place. So you know, we need to substitute for it though another life. We can't just think that this is a dream world and that we exist just as conscious beings with no content. And so you'll find, and this is with the title of my little seminar and presentation, if you will, in New Vrindavan, God is in the details. You know, God is in the details. Means that as much detail as we have here, we should know there's in the spiritual world. And we should want to find out what that is. How does that work? What is actually going on there? And by the grace of, you know, the Lord and his representative, especially Srila Prabhupada, we've been given the clue. I was just thinking of this verse in the Brahma Samhita. It's not such a famous Govinda prayer, but it's very pertinent. Yad bhava bhava dadayama najastatayava samprabha rupa mahimasa nayana bhusha suktayameva nagamapatitaistu vandi govinda madhi purusham tamahabhajani. So in this particular verse, Brahma says that I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord. He had a revelation. The whole spiritual world opened to him, and he's describing it in his prayers. So he says, the yogis, or the bhaktas, the devotees, they absorb their mind in their original sarup, in their original function. And in this way, they are rewarded their original form, conveyances, dress, everything. In other words, we have a certain role to play in the spiritual world, just suitable to our specific, custom-made relationship with Krishna. Well, just like in this world, you know, we have a certain form, right? A male form. We're all sitting here, males. Stay with us, Ben. Therefore, if we're going to have a relationship, say, with a woman, okay, then we identify with this particular form. We have a name, we have an age, we have a house, we have conveyances, we have dress, we have everything. It's all on the basis of this form, right? But we know that this form is just a dream. So at a certain point, you get old, it changes, die, and that relationship breaks. It's finished. So it's like it's a dreamlike relationship. But we have our original form, we have our original conveyance, we have our original dress, attitude, friends, everything. According to our original relationship with Krishna. It's called a rasa. So Krishna consciousness really means awakening to that. And that's real liberation. That's liberation in bhakti. So that's why it said the definition of liberation, mukti, it doesn't mean just being liberated from birth and death. That's part of it, but that's not all of it. Muktir hidvanyata rupam swarupena vivastati. This is the definition in Bhagavatam, second canon. So it means giving up all of these other rupas. This is just one form we've had, or even this lifetime we've had so many, right? Childhood, babyhood, boyhood, just like Krishna says, 2:13. And we'll continue to change forms until we give it up entirely. So, but that's just this body. We've had so many others. So it means giving up all those other forms and being situated in your swarup. Your swarup means the actual form, spiritual form of the soul that reflects exactly your particular relationship of loving exchange with Krishna. That's the swarup. And we're meant to learn that, to become aware of it progressively in Krishna consciousness. And to do that, we need to hear about Krishna's activities in the spiritual world. And that's why we have Krishna book. That's why we have the Bhagavad Purana. It culminates in the 10th canto. The activities of Krishna, all attractive in the eternal land of Vrindavan. And for this sampradaya especially, means this spiritual community, that's the goal. Going back to that intimate land, sweet land of Gokula, you know, in Goloka Vrindavan, which has a replica in the present-day Vrindavan. Idyllic land, described in the 10th canto. To engage in, you know, some relation with Krishna as a friend, parent, lover, whatever, servant. That's it. Okay, it's just like, you know, if you want to become a doctor or you want to become a musician or something, then now you have to train for that point. So when you get to be 25, you'll have your degree, you'll have your skill, you can act in that. You're actually changing your form. In other words, you're changing your nerves, you're changing your body, your mental body, so you can act in a certain way and enjoy the fruits of that relationship or that function. So therefore, we also have to train in this lifetime. But it's more of a rediscovering. The form is already there. Just like so many of us, I myself, I don't know, maybe I was some kind of drummer in my last life. From childhood, I was tapping away. I was into beats. My father was also a drummer. You know, and I, you know, even now I can beat away. I never learned formally the mridanga, but the sense of rhythm is there. You know, so that's a propensity that I had. You know, and I could develop now if I really wanted to develop it. I'd study the mridanga and get into it and do the whole thing. So you change from now until then, and you enjoy the fruits of that skill you develop. So we have deep down inside of us all this swarup. You know, and the basic principle of Sarup is Krishna Das, Lord Chaitanya says. Jivera Swarupoi, Krishnara Nitya Das, eternally. But how? What are the details of that service? That's what will take our mind away from the details of this dream we're living now. So don't neglect the details. You know, when we see Krishna on the altar, you know, absorb the beautiful details of the beautiful dressing and the smile and all these things. That's as important as the philosophy. Don't take it lightly. You know, because that attraction is what this is all about. Is, you know, withdrawing our attraction from this, our absorption in the matter, and putting it on Krishna. Any discussion? Yes, Prabhu?
My question being, it's kind of a two-part. So with the gopis in Vrindavan, I was reading in Krishna book, and it has to do with like Swarup. It was saying that they when they took the betel nuts from Krishna's mouth, from, you know, coming both type of affairs, they made spiritual advancement. And I'm just trying to understand how that would be implicated in regards to the swarup of like, do you like level up your swarup? Do you would I go from like, you know, being like a parental to then, oh, you know, now I'm going to the
all right, this is the famous change of rasa question.
Thank you.
Can you change your rasa? Well, first of all, the thing about the the gopis making spiritual advancement, I also kind of blinked twice when I read that. Well, aren't they already totally advanced to the final point? But it's interesting to note in the when you read the, you know, those rasa dance chapters, Prabhupada puts in a lot of purport there, so nobody can mistake this for any, you know, kind of ordinary relationship. But there's a huge explanation right at the beginning when the gopis all go out to, you know, to Krishna. Prabhupada quotes this purport, and we did the same thing when we worked on the 10th canto. This whole explanation: who are these gopis? And it turns out there's this four different groups of gopis, if I recall correctly. Some of them are Krishna's eternal associates from the Goloka Vrindavan. He brings them down with him. Others are the daughters of the demigods who also want to, you know, develop, you know, their relationship with Krishna in this rasa. They don't want to just be the daughters of the demigods. They don't want to live on the heavenly planets. They want to, you know, stay with Krishna. There are the municharis who are the sages of Dandakaranya forest. Danda means punishment, you know, or austerity. So Dandakaranya forest was the forest that Ram wandered in, you know, and that Ravana came and captured Sita. So when he went in his exile voluntarily with Sita and Lakshman, there were all of these sages meditating in there, you know, and they were being harassed by the demons and the Rakshasas, and Krishna, Rama protected them like that. So they wanted to have a relationship with him on this highest level, conjugal relation. And he said, no, in this incarnation, I have only ekapatni, and you have one wife. But so you'll have to take birth as gopis in Vrindavan later, because Ram predated Krishna in this kalpa. So they did that. They were able to, you know, come when Krishna came. They also came as daughters of gopis. So. And then there's the Upanishads. When you get to chapter 87, there's the prayers of personified Vedas. There's also some of them, not all of them, but some of them, groups of them, who long to have that relationship with Krishna. They also came down, and they're also there. So there's all these four. So now, when Krishna blew his flute and invited those gopis to come out, you know, they all started running out practically uncontrollably. You know, they didn't even have their hair directly. You know, they put down their babies, they're suckling them, taking a bath, whatever they're doing, they're immediately running, you know, going out. Some of them couldn't get out. They couldn't get out because they had their brothers and fathers and husbands. Where are you going? Middle of the night. You know, this is described. So what happened was that they started meditating. Now, it seems to be, you know, if you read Prabhupada's Krishna book, that they died. But it's explained by Vishnu Chakravarti, they didn't actually die. What did die was any remnants, any vestige of material desire. So even these gopis on this plane in Boma Vrindavan, Goloka Vrindavan, they're all there permanently. But here, some are graduating, moving up, you see. And there's also groups that are coming up from the earthly planet. So you have these different groups. In other words, just like we, you know, if it's possible, you know, we could be scheduled to graduate or to become one of Krishna's eternal intimate associates there. So wherever Krishna's appearing in whatever universe, then we could take birth there and, you know, complete the course and then go back to Goloka Vrindavan. It's described in Krishna. So now these gopis who were held back, they felt a tremendous suffering because they couldn't go to see Krishna. Right? Oh, you know, we can't go. So this is like burning, you know, virahaba. Virahaba means separation. But that also caused extreme bliss, because the separation from Krishna is a source of the highest ecstasy. You see? So now that's paradoxical. That's the next verse, Achintya. Very amazing. So now it's described there by Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur that the happiness they felt because of the longing to see Krishna, that pleasure, fulfilled any vestige of good karma that they had to burn off. And the pain that they felt, that not being able to go see Krishna, that was the fulfillment of all of their dushkriti, whatever remnant of bad karma was left. You see? So in this way, they became completely pure. So it's not inconceivable that some of those gopis in Boma Vrindavan with Krishna 5,000 years ago needed to make some spiritual advancement. You see? That was your question.
Yeah.
Right? So by taking that betel nut, they also made those fortunate ones. You know. But it's very fascinating to see, the background. Where are these gopis coming from? Who are they? They're the greatest sages. You know, they look like ordinary girls. But it's because they've already surpassed all of the rules and regulations and the yoga and everything. You know, that's way beyond. They're way beyond that. And the final goal of that is to be the simple coward girls whose one qualification is they absolutely love Krishna, more than anything else, more than life itself. And that's the final goal. Yeah, but then in the daytime they're just doing, chores at home, They don't know the Vedas very well, but they did learn a lot from listening to the Brahmins, Prabhupada said. It's very, endearing. So, there you go. Okay, so we're almost out of time. I think we'll leave this next one for tomorrow.
Sorry.
Or Monday. Huh?
Guru change?
Yeah. Generally, you don't change, especially in Goloka. It's not that you're going to become a parent and then say, well, I'd rather be a gopi.
Yeah.
Yeah, you already realize that. And one more, yeah?
Dr. Ryan was saying that in Satyaraj's book, and also Vrajbhasi said that when we go to Goloka Vrindavan, we're in simultaneously in Chaitanya Leela and then in Krishna Leela.
Yeah, if you want that. That's there. The Prabhupada talked about that. That there's the eternal kirtan going on, and at the same time there's Krishna's personal lila going on. So that you can be in several places at once. I mean, even just like when Krishna came, it's described that all the demigods, were supposed to come down and become the Yadu dynasty, take birth in the Yadu dynasty. Well, that doesn't mean that everything is vacant up there. You know what I'm saying? There's expansions. They expand and come down, yeah.
On the same point, is that the case with Nityasiddhas, like Srila Prabhupada? Like, he's simultaneous. He's in the eternal leela of Krishna, but...
If you want it. In other words, it's all... But at that stage, it's simply... Krishna is amenable to fulfill your desires for service. Especially intimate servant like that. So you can be in Lord Chaitanya Leela and you can be in Krishna Radha Krishna Leela simultaneously.
But
there's no restriction. I don't know. I don't know. He never revealed. I mean, sometimes Prabhupada would say he would keep coming back to this world to deliver his disciples. And he would say, but don't make me do that. But some of them, they're not doing so well. So that's the great mercy of the acharyas. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.